You're listening to Decisive Point. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. I'm talking with Dr. Zanel Garcia and Dr. Philip Guerrero today about their InFocus special commentary,
What American Policymakers Misunderstand About the Belt and Road Initiative. You can find it in the summer 2024 issue of Parameters. Garcia is an associate professor of security studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College. His research focuses on the intersection of international relations theory, security, and geopolitics in the Indo-Pacific and Eurasia. Guerrero is an instructor of political science at the Department of Political Science at the University of Arkansas. His research focuses on water security and environmental politics in China and Southeast Asia. It's great to have you back, Zanel. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you.
How does the Biden-Harris administration frame the Belt and Road Initiative?
So I think the Biden-Harris administration is not unique in the way that they're framing the Belt and Road Initiative. And by that, I mean that for a little bit over a decade that the Belt and Road has been operative, the general view in American foreign policy circles has been that the Belt and Road fundamentally represents a grand strategy on China's part that reflects a clear geopolitical intent to reshape the international order. And if you use that framing, the output of that is basically that the Belt and Road fundamentally sits opposite to American interests worldwide. And so some of the things that this current administration, but also its predecessors have pursued, is deter other countries from participating in the Belt Road, but also mobilizing discourses to discourage other countries from doing so. And the debt trap narrative is one of these core ones that gets mobilized quite regularly by American officials, even though for the past decade that this has been studied by scholars, nobody has found empirical evidence of debt trap.
You disagree with the Biden administration's approach. Tell me why.
I have two core reasons, and that's kind of the crux of the paper, for why I think that framing is incorrect. One, it attributes way too much centrality to the Belt and Road Initiative, when in practice, it's a lot more fragmented. The origins and the development of the Belt and Road clearly illustrates a very fragmented approach to policy formulation and implementation. And the second part, which I think is also incredibly problematic, is that it ignores the fact that participant countries in the Belt and Road Initiative have exercised significant capacity in shaping how the Belt and Road is implemented in their respective countries.
Tell us about the role of provinces in Chinese domestic politics and your case study of Yunnan.
Building off what Zanel said about fragmentation in Chinese politics and the perception the U.S. administrations have, provincial officials actually have a lot of leeway in spearheading domestic and regional or international infrastructure projects. Many of the projects today that we have put under the Belt and Road Initiative umbrella predate the Belt and Road Initiative to begin with, and then they were eventually given the stamp of a Belt and Road Initiative. It runs very much counter to the narrative this is a mastermind political agenda from one singular individual, when it's in actuality provincial officials molding their pre-existing plans or future plans to match a national narrative and have access to those funds and national support. And so for Yunnan, we're largely looking at cross-border investment between Yunnan and Southeast Asia. So looking at Laos, Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, the Indochina Peninsula, so to speak. And some of the major projects such as hydropower development, these projects originate in 2011, well before the 2013 Belt and Road Initiative. So we see officials adapting pre-existing projects that would largely benefit their region and, of course, China as a whole to meet a national narrative.
How do Belt and Road participant countries effectively exercise agency?
Well, that's the tricky part, right? Because it's infrastructure. And one doesn't simply force a cross-border infrastructure project. It's too complicated when we're talking about large-scale infrastructure projects. For example, my specialty is hydropower and dams, where if we're arguing that a downstream state or a Southeast Asian state does not wish to play ball with a highway or a high-speed rail, it might cost more what we can build around. When we look at hydropower, the river is going to be there. That potential is going to be there. So for certain projects, these smaller countries in Southeast Asia do have the ability to say yes or no to a project, while ultimately it is a bidding process as well. And more often than not, China is the winning competitor on these bids. which is also favorable to them through regional ties and political ties as well. So these states do have the capacity to say no or alter projects to meet their needs, to the point where they're getting favorable deals for a reason.
What are the implications of your findings for U.S. policy?
I think one of the most important findings of this work for American policy is that if ultimately the Belt and Road is fragmented, which means there's a lot of domestic stakeholders within China that are trying to compete with each other to shape the policy itself, and that also participant countries can shape the implementation of the Belt and Road as well, then one, it undermines the notion that this is some clear grand strategic plan that has clear geopolitical outcomes. And if that is accurate, then that means that the United States can find ways to engage the Belt and Road Initiative, in other words, have a seat at the table, to shape it and mold it in ways that can potentially mitigate some of its existing concerns about the Belt and Road more broadly. So ultimately, if we know that downstream countries or participant countries are able to shape the Belt and Road, then partnerships with those countries can help, one, those countries extract the benefits that they seek, and two, mitigate what we think could be problems, which is potentially debt exposure, which is perhaps graft, corruption. All of these things are roles that the United States can play on the governance side of things, but also it has a role to play economically. And by that, I mean, we already know that hundreds of Western firms and banks already participate in thousands of Belt and Road projects. And so it appears to me that we're kind of missing the train, if you will. We don't have a coherent strategy that matches the reality.
We have a little bit of extra time. Did we miss anything, or is there anything else that you want to address?
When we're looking at it, like Zanel said, as a grand scheme project, our responses are going to be trying to match a grand scheme project. And since it's not that, we're addressing something that doesn't exist. And I think rather than trying to approach it as a counter to the Belt and Road Initiative, policymakers should start considering integrative projects. Once I build a dam, you can't build another dam right next to it as a competition. That infrastructure is built. That's one of the things about large-scale infrastructures. If we build a national highway here, are you going to build the same one at the same length for the same targeted economic development in that area? No. So you need to integrate yourself within the infrastructure of the region overall. It's not essentially countering, but more integrative or targeting the needs of the recipient state rather than countering Chinese projects in these regions.
I want to piggyback off that too, because one of our concluding remarks is that in the 21st century, the United States is going to have to operate in a more resource-constrained environment. And so if you approach the Belt and Road as a grand strategy that universally has these detrimental effects on American interests, you're going to be playing whack-a-mole globally. And that's not going to be an efficient use of existing resources. And to Phil's point, I think it highlights the participant country's agency in a very unique way. If I am Vietnam, if I am Cambodia, Thailand, Laos, I'm not viewing the Belt and Road and American proposals as necessarily competitive. I'm seeing them as complementary. Because if the Chinese are coming in and they build the hydropower to generate energy, they build economic development zone to bring in investment from factories. They're building the roads or railways to connect those economic development zones. And then ultimately, it's American, Japanese, Korean firms that are populating those economic development zones. If I'm the host countries, that's a win-win for me. And by the way, if I'm a Western investor, I don't want to be building roads. I don't want to be building energy generation power plants. In fact, most of those things don't have significant economic return. A highway and a railway on their own do not make you a lot of money. It is the economic activity that happens around it that fundamentally matters. So if the Chinese want to build the heavy infrastructure, the capitally intensive infrastructure in these countries, as a Western firm or Western bank, I'm more than happy to take up the easier job, which is I'm just going to populate the development zones with my businesses and basically leverage consistent energy generation and logistics through better infrastructure and ports.
Thank you both so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie, as always.
Listeners, you can download the article at press.armywarcollege.edu/parameters. Look for issue 54, volume 2.
For more Army War College podcasts, check out Conversations on Strategy, SSI Live, and A Better Peace.